Divided We Watch. Has Television Lost Its Power to Bring Americans Together? By Alan Greenblatt. Jay Farrow sometimes leads his audiences in sing-alongs. It's probably not what they were expecting when they decided to see the comedian and former Saturday Night Live star. Still, all Farrow has to do is sing the first few words of theme songs from old sitcoms such as The Facts of Life or The Fresh Prince of Bel-Air, and suddenly, just about everybody in the crowd is singing right along with him. It is a demonstration of the power of television, or the power it used to have. Television was truly a mass medium, with Americans watching the same shows at the same time by the tens of millions, and then often watching them over and over in reruns. That's no longer what television is about. A medium that was dominated a half century ago by three broadcast networks is now a combination of hundreds of cable channels and a seemingly endless supply of streaming services. That's before you start reckoning with the billions of videos people can watch on YouTube or TikTok. For at least eight decades from the beginning of electronic media, we had gathered the largest consensus audience in the history of planet Earth, says Robert Thompson, a professor of television and pop culture at Syracuse University. Cable began to change that, and streaming has broken that into a million pieces. The TV audience has certainly fragmented, and given last year's strikes in Hollywood and the continuing financial struggles of streaming services, experts such as Thompson expect that the coming years will continue to see massive changes in what we watch and how we watch it. The past 10 years have seen more change in television than any other years in its history, except for the first 10, says Jason Middle, a media studies professor at Middlebury College. Regardless of how it gets delivered to us, though, television continues to demand our attention and shape our culture. Broadcast and cable, while much diminished, still account for half of Americans' total viewing time. Programs produced by traditional TV networks also make up an awful lot of what people stream. Television has been one of the most influential inventions in U.S. history, alongside electricity, automobiles, and the Internet. It has shaped the way we live, what we eat, and how we govern ourselves. It's worth looking back at how it's shaped American culture over the past 70 years, as it's held up what might be described as a distorted mirror to society. The thing you always have to remember about television is that sometimes it leads, sometimes it reflects, and sometimes it follows, says David Bianculli, a television historian at Rowan University. Really, it was radio that began the breakthrough, offering an immediate connection to the outside world. Instead of having to go out for entertainment, radio brought it into the home, making it suddenly private and domestic. You can look up pictures of families gathered together around the radio to listen to Fibber McGee and Molly, a President Franklin D. Roosevelt's fireside chats. The revolution of television was simply piggybacking on the real revolution, which was radio. Thompson says, you could bring live information and entertainment, whatever was important or frivolous, into each and every home. While radio had a tremendous effect, it lacked the visual power television would bring. Once that technology became commercially available, the adoption of television was immediate. There were roughly 7,000 TV sets in the entire country in 1948. 5 years later, half of all U.S. households had one. In 1953, 29 million Americans watched the episode of I Love Lucy, in which the title character gave birth. 3 years later, 60 million Americans watched Elvis Presley make his debut appearance on The Ed Sullivan Show, the Sunday night variety program that lasted into the 1970s. Television had intruded into U.S. homes in a big way, and people adapted their homes to accommodate it. They bought overstuffed lounge chairs for comfy viewing and TV trays for ease of eating, dining on frozen meals that were quick to prepare. Plenty of people warned that TV was rotting brains. The children wouldn't want to do their homework anymore, says Catherine Fuller Seely, a University of Texas communication professor, summarizing popular complaints of the time. Parents and doctors worried about them going blind. In a famous speech in 1961, FCC Chairman Newton Minow called commercial television a vast wasteland. This has happened with nearly every major new medium that comes along, from the printing press to comic books and video games. It's going to be the death of civilization and the ruin of children and everyone's attention spans. But people loved TV. Immediately, in most households, it becomes the center of domestic life, Thompson says, consistently set up in the biggest public space in the house. Everyone watched, and everyone watched pretty much the same stuff. Television was completely dominated by the three major networks, CBS, NBC, and ABC, which between them commanded 90% of the primetime viewing audience into the 1970s. 75 million people tuned in to the last of the Kennedy-Nixon presidential debates in 1960, when the total population was 180 million. Okay, maybe they did have longer attention spans back then. Both candidates made opening statements that lasted 8 minutes. It's passed into political folklore that Richard Nixon lost the election because he looked sweaty and furtive on TV. People listening on radio thought he'd done better. The cameras may or may not have been decisive, but they would have a profound effect on political events throughout that decade. While radio had returned to entertainment programs shortly after the Pearl Harbor bombing in 1941, television offered essentially uninterrupted coverage for the 4 days in 1963 between President John F. Kennedy's assassination and his burial. Images of civil rights marchers being beaten as they crossed a bridge in Selma, Alabama, shocked the nation and led to passage of the 1965 Voting Rights Act. Not just television, but other forms of mass media, such as magazines like Time, Newsweek, and Life, reached enormous audiences, but offered limited portrayals of the country. It was rare to see African Americans or other minority groups represented. One reason the 1960s were such a tumultuous period was that marginalized voices had to be disruptive to get attention, suggests Aniko Bodrokozi, a media studies professor at the University of Virginia. The more limited media environment, network news and the major news magazines all subscribed to a kind of consensus approach to politics, which is a narrow approach, she says, so a lot of voices didn't get heard, which is one reason that you have movements like the civil rights movement and the student movement and the gay rights movement. The war in Vietnam became known as the Living Room War, as people at home watched footage of U.S. soldiers fighting overseas for the first time. CBS anchor Walter Cronkite, known as the most trusted man in America, made on-air comments in 1968 stating that the war would end in a stalemate. President Lyndon B. Johnson said, "If I've lost Cronkite, I've lost Middle America." We'd have been in that war without television, says Thompson, but I'm not sure we would have gotten out of it when we did without television. Television became the central focus for presidential campaigning and much of the rest of politics. There were major events that led people to turn, almost instinctively at that point, to television, such as the moon landing in 1969, the launch and sudden explosion of the space shuttle Challenger in 1986, and the terrorist attacks of 2001. But over the years, the way people tune in to major events has changed, notably with the advent of social media. In 1969, Nixon's vice president, Spiro Agnew, complained that the big city liberal media was intellectually dishonest. A tiny and closed fraternity of privileged men elected by no one, who did not represent the views of America. Complaints about liberal media bias, of course, have only grown louder in the decades since, with Fox News offering a more conservative viewpoint since its launch in 1996. In the 1970s, even sitcoms grew liberal, from the anti-war comedy MASH to the portrayal of a bigot on All in the Family. In more recent decades, sympathetic portrayals of gay characters on shows such as Will and Grace and Modern Family helped make much of the country more accepting of same-sex marriage. Technology brought Americans more choice. During the 1970s, most people had essentially the same three choices, with cable still used only to boost broadcast signals. By 1980, however, cable began to come into its own, with CNN, BET, and Cinemax all launching that year, and MTV and the Disney Channel following soon after. Almost half of U.S. homes were wired for cable by 1985, with the average number of channels per household climbing from less than 5 to more than 20 before ultimately reaching into the hundreds. Some of that sense of choice was an illusion. 17 of the top 20 basic cable networks in 2001 were owned by four companies. But people grew accustomed to being able to watch what they wanted when they wanted, first through VCRs, then TiVo and other digital recorders, then DVDs, and finally streaming. In 1984, the Supreme Court ruled that home taping of broadcasts was legal, provided it was for personal use. Only 1% of U.S. households owned VCRs in 1980. By 1991, 72% of households owned at least one. By that time, it had become common for households to have multiple TVs. The days of the whole family gathering around the set in the living room were over, even if that ritual still sometimes gets recreated on holidays and special occasions. Maybe that's facetious, but it's certainly common now for members of the same household to watch entirely different material in different rooms on different devices, whether TikTok dance-offs or comedy specials, while the main TV set is being used not for programming, but video games. There's now more TV than any individual can possibly watch. The number of separate, scripted TV shows peaked in 2022 at just under 600. Naturally, there were fewer last year when the actor and writer strikes dragged on for months. The industry is entering a period of retrenchment at this point, with cable losing about 10% of its subscribers each year and most streaming services hemorrhaging money. The days of proliferating productions is drawing to a close. The content is better than ever. Better dramas, better comedies, better documentaries. But it's not a sustainable model, says Bian Cooley, who is also a TV critic for NPR's Fresh Air. At this point, plenty of pundits blame the fractured media environment for polarized politics. Americans were divided during the 1960s, when there was practically a media monoculture. But now individuals can live entirely within their chosen echo chambers, never hearing a voice that cuts across differences to unify the country, if such a voice exists. There's no doubt in my mind that it has encouraged a sense of isolation. Mittal says, people believe the vision of America they're getting on television, the way they're watching it, is real, and all the other stuff is nonsense or propaganda. Even as the TV industry shrinks, with major streaming platforms widely expected to merge and consolidate, the television audience will never cohere the way it once did. Where the top shows used to draw audiences of 40 million or more, the average episodes of even the most popular shows today including NCIS, Chicago Fire, and 60 Minutes, reach fewer than 10 million viewers each. There may soon be a new Big Three, made up of Netflix and a couple of other surviving streamers. But even when people watch the same platform, they aren't watching the same shows, like in the old days. On the other hand, we're not watching as many different things as you may think. It's possible now to devote yourself mainly to videos of volcanic eruptions or car crashes or, surprisingly popular with the kids, other people playing video games. But despite the amount of choice, or maybe because of it, most are watching a relatively small number of shows, including lots of older shows, such as The Office and Gilmore Girls. The sheer volume leads to a level of paralysis for some people, says Alyssa Perrin, a professor of radio, TV, film at the University of Texas. The infinite choice leads us back to Friends, or not even picking. Or maybe people just want to watch an old show they've built up a relationship with, to the point they can sing along with the theme song if given the opportunity to do so. Alan Greenblatt is the editor of Governing. Sidebars. Streaming boom turns bust. Hope you enjoyed the past few years of streaming, because the good times are coming to an end. When streaming services ate away at the cable market, that turned out to be a great deal for consumers, for a while. For about $7 a month, you could get nearly unlimited access to series and movies of your choice, with studios, networks, and tech companies falling over themselves to provide high-end content at low, low prices. In an effort to build their consumer bases and please Wall Street, streaming platforms have been willing to spend tens of millions per episode, or drop some $200 million, as Apple did, on a prestige movie like Killers of the Flower Moon. Netflix alone signed contracts worth more than $100 million each with producers Shonda Rhimes and Ryan Murphy, as well as the Obamas. Comic actor Adam Sandler got $250 million to produce four movies. Big-name producers will still do all right, but smaller fish started getting cut from their contracts as soon as the Hollywood strikes ended last year. Netflix is profitable, but Comcast, Disney, Paramount, and Warner collectively lost about $5 billion on streaming last year. They're going to have to keep raising prices and having less content, says Catherine Fuller Seeley, a communication professor at the University of Texas. All the major streaming services have raised prices, on average, about 25% last year. Most are pushing subscribers to accept packages that include ads. The subscribers aren't happy. One in four have canceled at least three streaming subscriptions over the past couple of years. There's still plenty to watch, but the days of getting everything for practically nothing are over. $5 billion. Combined losses for the four largest entertainment companies from their streaming services in 2023. July 2023, the first month in which the combined audience for broadcast and cable fell below 50% of total viewership. 1939, NBC broadcasts the opening of the World's Fair and the first televised baseball game, Princeton versus Columbia. 1947, Meet the Press debuts and becomes the nation's longest-running program, now in its 77th season. 1949, the Fairness Doctrine requires broadcasters to devote equal time to controversial issues of public importance and to give airtime to those with opposing views. 1954, ABC airs the Army McCarthy hearings, leading to a collapse in support for Wisconsin Senator Joe McCarthy. 1955, CBS's popular The $64,000 Question sparks a TV game show craze. 1961, President Kennedy gives the first live televised press conference. 1963, Americans say, for the first time, that they get more of their news from TV than newspapers. 1964, the Beatles perform on The Ed Sullivan Show, drawing 73 million viewers. 1969, an estimated 650 million people around the world watch Neil Armstrong's first steps on the moon. 1970, Monday Night Football debuts on ABC. 1973, Variety calls the Senate Watergate hearings summer's hottest daytime soap opera. 1979, the Iranian hostage crisis dominates nightly news for more than a year, negatively affecting Americans' opinion of the Carter presidency. 1980, CNN debuts along with a number of other cable channels. 1983, the last episode of MASH draws 125 million viewers, at a time when only 83 million households have TVs. 1986, Space Shuttle Challenger explodes shortly after launch as millions of schoolchildren watch. 1987, the Federal Communications Commission drops the Fairness Doctrine. 1988, VCRs are in a majority of U.S. households, revolutionizing how people watch TV and depriving advertisers of captive audiences. 1994, O.J. Simpson leads police on a televised 90-minute chase in a white Ford Bronco. 2000, Survivor airs the first of 46 seasons so far. 2001, an estimated 2 billion people watch the 9/11 terror attacks in real time or the day's news about it. 2005, YouTube is launched. 2007, Netflix, then a DVD-by-mail company, begins allowing streaming as a perk to subscribers. 2017, total number of U.S. cable subscribers peaks at 98.7 million. 2019, major studios, including Disney, launch their own streaming services. 2020, Netflix tops the 200 million subscriber mark. 599, scripted English language shows produced in 2022. From networks to Netflix, the first decades of television were dominated by the same three networks that ruled radio. Watching TV meant watching affiliate stations of CBS, NBC, and ABC. PBS wasn't established until the end of the 1960s, and only large cities had independent stations. Having to please everyone meant producers had to pull plenty of punches. Characters couldn't say dirty words, and storylines mostly had to avoid controversial topics. Broadcast TV, complained producer David Chase, has an unerring system for detecting whatever it is that gets you excited about a project and tells you to get rid of it. Broadcast, nevertheless, continued its dominance through the 1970s. The Who Shot J.R. episode of Dallas, which aired in 1980, drew 83 million viewers, more people than voted in that year's presidential election. But that proved to be one of the last great peaks of the network era. Cable came along in a big way during the 1980s. Where only 15% of U.S. households had cable in 1976, nearly 40% were wired by 1983. There was a proliferation of cable channels, many of which, AMC, FX, and HBO, became known for granting creative freedom to producers. By 1999, the share of the primetime audience commanded by the three networks had fallen below 60% for the first time. Known for airing movies without commercial interruptions, HBO lost that competitive advantage with the advent of video rentals. The network had produced occasional original shows starting in the 1980s, but stepped up its game by the late 1990s with series such as Deadwood, Sex in the City, and Chase's The Sopranos. After a while, we had proven that you could have both creative opportunity and big success, says Chris Albrecht, a longtime head of the network. When Netflix was founded in 1997, it wasn't taken seriously as a threat by Blockbuster, than the leading video rental chain, let alone networks and studios. But Netflix quickly found a profitable niche, renting DVDs by mail. When it launched its Watch Now service in 2007, it was a giveaway to subscribers, with slow internet connections sending streaming video only to computers. Within a few years, however, it was possible to watch on TV sets. But the networks and studios still didn't worry they were building up a competitor by licensing their content to Netflix. In a statement that would become notorious in the industry, Time Warner CEO Jeff Bewkes in 2010 dismissed the threat. "It's a little bit like, is the Albanian army going to take over the world?" he said. Recognizing that their competitors would eventually figure this out, Netflix began airing original shows such as House of Cards and Orange is the New Black. Overnight, Netflix redefined internet content, which heretofore had been synonymous with skateboarding fails, music videos, and cheap, low-quality fare. Write journalists Dade Hayes and Don Shimoleski in Binge Times, Their History of the Streaming Business. After spotting Netflix a 10-year head start, Apple, Disney, Warner, and NBC all launched their own streaming services over a 7-month period in 2019 and 2020. It was a golden moment for streaming. The pandemic made homebound viewers practically addicted. But by then, Netflix had built an almost insurmountable lead. NBC had paid $500 million to Netflix to get streaming rights back for one of its own shows, The Office, while Warner paid $425 million for Friends. Although Netflix enjoyed an operating margin of about 20% last year, its major competitors continued to lose money. Meanwhile, cable networks such as USA, TBS, MTV, and the Comedy Channel, which used to produce original dramas and comedies, are now zombie channels with lineups made up of little more than reruns.